such meaningless thought. The shell appears strong, but the inside is rot. It's time to be stirred. The time is now. The winds have changed. Read the signs. No time to hide. The winds have changed.
Millennia ago, from the little cave on the tiny island of Patmos in the Aegean Sea, the heavens opened. Since then, the world has been fascinated by the cosmic upheaval brewing on the horizon of history. The upheaval is now upon us. It is within us. To some degree, it always has been. But there has been a sudden and violent shift in the affairs of the world. The winds have changed. Heaven will not be silent. Let's now join Father Anthony Bush, pastor of St. Stanislaus Kostka, the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy in Chicago, and author of A Mother's Plea, For the Winds Have Changed. Together we can pave the way for a hopeful response to the signs of our times.
Hey, welcome everyone. God bless you for tuning in to The Winds of Change. Father Tom Coyce here with you once again to wrinkle your brain a bit. And we are... Hey, thank you, friends, for joining us. Thank you very much. You can take a seat over there. There's still a few seats left here in our studio. It's Holy Week. Or it's Easter week, my friends, the week after Holy Week. I thought we got to do some rain wrinkling on talking about heaven, talking about the resurrection, because that's what Easter's all about, right? Yeah, well, I'm not going to show you the money. I'm going to show you the greatest payoff there is. I'm going to show you heaven, you know. And you know what, Nick? We do have this reward room that we keep in the office over here in the studio. And if you open the reward room, you do get a little glimpse into heaven, you see. I could just barely make it out, but... you know, we had to install that after we were, after we had the punishment room.
You just wrinkled my brain.
Yeah, that is brain wrinkling. When we installed the punishment room because we do want to keep this a very professional and top-notch radio show and studio. And if you're not working on responsibility, personal responsibility, then you're not going to improve. And part of personal responsibility is applauding what is good, booing what is bad, rewarding the virtuous, and shunning the vicious. You must keep these more categories alive, or else you stagnate. That's somewhat of a lead into actually this topic of heaven. There's two ways I think we could start to dive into what is heaven. You have to tie them together, and I think they do reveal themselves as tied together. One is thinking of heaven just in terms of what is the resurrection like? What is the resurrected body like? Jesus rose from the dead, and he appears to his apostles and disciples and friends, and it's clear, it's evidently clear in the gospel stories that... his resurrected body has powers that our normal bodies don't have. It's clear that those who aren't sharing in the resurrection yet are blinded, are somehow kept from seeing and understanding and knowing who Jesus was because of his resurrected body, or because maybe power that he, our Lord, had over the minds of the people. I think that's part of... there, yeah, see, we got that door just keeps sliding open there. that's one way to think about the theme of heaven is concentrating on the resurrected body. Another way is to contemplate the idea of eternity. Because we are finite creatures, we are finite beings, infinity is something we can imagine. We could try to imagine. You can't picture infinity or the eternal because every picture we have, every image that we can conjure up is by its nature limited. It's not infinite. So it is a great term that we should pray about and that we should long for. My wonderful sister gave a great little thought at our Easter dinner when she noticed that in Holy Week you make a big deal out of Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. And if you go to Holy Thursday night, if you go to Friday, and you go to the Easter Vigil, or the Saturday is the day in the tomb for our Lord. And she said, you know, we concentrate on that sad part of the mystery of the Lord. We should have, and she didn't know she was being a wise liturgist when she said, we should have at least 3 days of celebrating Easter. Since we have 3 days of contemplating his passion. And I said, I said you just
wrinkled my brain, man.
Well, the church just wrinkled her brain because that is exactly what the church thinks and has us do. If you go to Mass every day, you'll see that the weekday Mass has the Gloria and the Creed. It's supposed to be celebrated like one day. The octave of Easter is one day, liturgically speaking. And that dovetails into one of Peter Kreft's beautiful insights about heaven, where time has to take on a new meaning. I love this topic, and I know I've touched on it before, but since it's the octave of Easter, we got to talk about it some more. Time being transformed, not into non-time, like, oh, there is no time, like we say when we're running out of time. You got a lot to do and not enough time to do it. We say, there's not enough time for this. Like in one of my favorite movies, Gettysburg, when General Robert E. Lee is punishing Jeb Stuart for showing up late at Gettysburg. Jeb Stuart was the general of the cavalry, and they did their first day without the cavalry. And so Robert E. Lee says, don't you know that as the cavalry, you are the eyes of this army? We don't know what's beyond those hills if we don't have a cavalry. We don't know what's beyond those trees. You have to explore.
I don't know.
He didn't know, but that's what... General Robert E. Lee really lays into him and says what a terrible mistake it was that he showed up so late. And Jeb Stuart is about to hand him his sword. Since I disappointed the great general, I will resign. That's the noble thing to do. And to which Robert E. Lee pounds the desk and says, we have no time for this. We have no time. What am I supposed to put out a search party and get a new general for my cavalry when we're going to be marching into war in a few hours? We all know what it is like when we say we have no time. But to say that in heaven we walk into eternity is not at all like that. It would be so much more to say something like, we have all the time in the world. Sometimes we even say that, right? We have all the time in the world. When do we say that? Well, we say that perhaps on the first day of vacation, of a long vacation. You don't say that on the last day of your vacation because you know your vacation is going to be ending soon, and you didn't do everything you wanted to do. But we sometimes say, we have all the time in the world, which of course you don't. You don't have all the time.
That's
not
fair.
It's not.
That's not fair at all.
No, it wouldn't be fair.
Not fair.
Well, that's a good Twilight Zone little clip there. That was a Twilight Zone, Nick. I don't know if you remember where that came from. That was when when the fella was trapped in a bomb shelter when a bomb exploded and destroyed the whole world. He was the only one who came out of the bomb shelter alive, and he always wanted to have time to read books. So now he had all the time in the world, all the... Bridges Meredith, thank you very much. That was the an early episode of Twilight Zone with a young Bridges Meredith. So anyways, now he has all the time in the world because no job, nowhere to go, nothing to do, but he discovers the library walls were all blown up by the bomb, but all the books were spewed about, and so he was able to collect all his books, and he was going to sit down and just read, where he always wanted to read, have time to read, and he had all the time in the world. But with the crazy twist of the Twilight Zone, he unfortunately steps on his reading glasses, and since he is so poor, they fall off his face, and he smashes them, and that's where he cries, "It's not fair!" Now he has all the time in the world, but nothing to do. And so he's there's so many different. It's a beautiful. It's a great topic to chew on and try to think of. And so I thank my wonderful sister Mary Lou, who gave that little insight. We should have more days to celebrate the resurrection, or at least as many days as we contemplated the Passion. And so, but that is exactly what the Catholic Church in our liturgy has us do. And by thinking of 7 days, or the octave of Easter, 8 days, as one day, it does put a twist. What do you mean 8 days are as one day? It's supposed to make you contemplate about a different meaning about time in eternity. Reaching God, we're going to be in the presence of the eternal. And so since God is so good, God is good. It's not that he's just so good. He's the definition of good. He's the essence of goodness. There is no evil in him. Being in God's presence for eternity, we will appreciate deeper and deeper aspects of goodness, and we will be hidden from, we will be spared from all aspects of bad and evil. I had another wonderful friend give an insight about heaven. He's my chiropractor, Dr. Ken Torrens. God bless you if you're listening. And we were talking about Easter, and he gave a very curious comment. You know, as we sometimes so often do. He's a wonderful Catholic guy, helps organize many things Regnum Christi and men's groups and what have you. He was part of the group that organized the Carrying the Cross in downtown. But anyways, Dr. Ken, he said, you know, I got a question. So we're in Easter here, and he says, I'm kind of wondering about the virtue of hope. And the way he put it was very, very, very deep, I think, because he said what I think a lot of us would say or should say if we're honest. He says, you know, I sort of understand the virtue of charity, you know, in the context of the three theological virtues, faith, hope, and charity. He says, I kind of understand what charity is about, love, being good and putting the other person's good in front of you, or even above you if necessary. Charity, it may be hard to do, and it may be hard to live completely, but it doesn't really present such a mystery. And I think he's right about that. And even with faith, you know, you study, there's somewhat more mystery to faith, but we sort of have a handle on that. You're asked to believe things that are not sort of readily apparent. You're asked to believe that God exists. You're asked to believe that God is a triune God of three persons in one. You're asked to believe that Jesus died and rose from the dead. You're asked to believe the Eucharist is the real presence of the Lord, body, blood, soul, and divinity of Whoa. Jesus. You're asked
you
to
just
believe.
Wrinkle my brain, man.
Yeah, those are brain wrinkling things. And that's all part of faith, what faith is. And there may be a lot more. We want to deepen our faith. We want to have stronger faith. We want to know what else, Lord, you would have us put our faith in, right? We're going to put our faith in the church. We're going to put our faith in our family members. We're going to put our faith in our parents, our children, our job, blah, blah, blah. You know, there's a lot that goes into that, but it's not as mysterious. But Dr. Ken said, but what about hope? Hope is different because that virtue, this theological virtue of hope, where does it intersect with our life? You know, what are we hoping in that is a supernatural hope? And that's the key, because we all know what hope is in a natural way. We all have hopes for today, for tomorrow, this weekend. I hope I can get away this weekend. I hope to find the right someone to marry. I hope I get a good job. I hope this dinner turns out to be wonderful. I hope this, I hope that. But the theological virtue of hope is not that. The theological virtue is not just hoping we can get what we want or have what we need, et cetera. It touches on the topic of heaven. It touches on, I'm hoping for heaven. Well, what are we hoping for when we hope for heaven? And if you don't have something different than just what our natural hopes are, then you don't have the theological virtue of hope. Am I making any sense up there? I think so. I'm breaking my own brain. But we're going to take a break here and come right back, because you're listening to listener-supported The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
Celebrate the glorious feast of the Divine Mercy this Sunday in the historic St. Stanislaus Kostka Church, the sanctuary of the Divine Mercy for the Archdiocese of Chicago. Confessions will be offered beginning at 2 p.m. Mass will be celebrated at 3 p.m., followed by the Divine Mercy Chaplet. A plenary indulgence can be obtained on this feast day. St. Stanislaus Kostka Church is located just minutes from downtown Chicago at 1327 North Noble Street. That's 1327 North Noble Street, one block west of the Kennedy Expressway at the Division Street exit. Plenty of free parking available. For more information, call 773-278-2470. 773-278-2470. That's 773-278-2470. St. Stanislaus Kostka Church, the sanctuary of the Divine Mercy, is open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, year-round, for adoration of the Blessed Sacrament.
The Winds of Change. The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ. And on the World Wide Web at windsofchangeshow.com.
Father Loya invites you to an extraordinary occasion of healing, hope, and grace. Monday and Tuesday, April 29th and 30th, as Annunciation Byzantine Catholic Parish in Homer Glen, Illinois, hosts the world-renowned international pilgrim Virgin Statue of Fatima. Come and hear the story of Fatima and venerate this image of Our Blessed Lady that has set out from Fatima, Portugal in 1947 to bring the graces of Fatima to all. Hundreds of favors and graces, including cures and countless conversions, have been associated with this image. The International Pilgrim Virgin Statue of Fatima, Monday and Tuesday, April 29th and 30th at Annunciation Byzantine Catholic Parish, 14610 Wilcook Road in Homer Glen, Illinois. For complete schedule and information, visit ByzantineCatholic.com. That's ByzantineCatholic.com.
Hey, welcome everyone. God bless you for tuning in. Nice to hear that little promo there for Father Loya's event with the Fatima statue. Father Loya is sort of a neighbor of mine out there in the southwest corner of the Chicagoland area. God bless him. And sometimes a host right here at Winds of Change. So Father Loya, if you're out there listening, a big shout out to you as well. Speaking of little announcements too, I might as well throw one in of St. James of the Sag, where I'm from. We were having an interesting talk on May 11th, Saturday, May 11th. There's a professor at Notre Dame University, South Bend, as it were, and yeah, I don't know how they found him, but it seems like a very strong Orthodox Catholic science professor. I don't know if he has one foot in the science department, another foot in the religion department, but he has a book out called Science and Faith. Professor Chris Baglaw will be at St. James of the Sag on Saturday, May 11th, 7 p.m. in our little historic Sag Hall church. Sag Hall, that's what we call it, at St. James Church. Keep that in mind, everyone. Since I'm on a run, I'm just going to throw out another one. On June 1st, Saturday, June 1st, so you might remember the name Kevin Matthews, who was an old DJ on The Loop Radio. I used to turn him off quite often because he was too crude for me, even when I was a young whippersnapper. But he has gone through quite a conversion, as it were, and he has a ministry called Broken Mary. Beautiful, beautiful story. And in getting to know him and hearing his talk about Broken Mary, I discovered he has multiple sclerosis. And some of you who know me, I know my brother, John, had multiple sclerosis. Unfortunately, God took my brother John last November. We've been doing a multiple sclerosis fundraiser bike-a-thon for years. So this year is going to be the first one without John. It's going to be a little extra hard for us. And we're trying to make it a little extra special in memory of John. Our bike riding team is called Go Johnny Go from that song last year. We often have done it for many years. My brother John would get in his hand pump cycle. He couldn't do the whole 75 miles. God knows that. But he would, we'd get him in, we'd get 5, 6, 7, 8 miles before the finish line, and we'd pedal in together. And when we crossed the finish line, the DJ playing the music for all the people crossing the finish line would throw on Go Johnny Go. It's quite a touching little family memory there that I'm sharing with you. But anyway, since I got to know Kevin Matthews, then he had MS. He's going to be with us on June 1st in St. James of the Sag, Saturday, June 1st. And another sister of mine, Margie, is organizing a concert of 60s, 70s, and 80s music for some of us old folks. But I want as many young folks to come too, because the 60s, 70s, and 80s have the best sing-along music. As you know, I'm a fan of sing-along music. And I lament the fact that much modern music is void of sing-along music. So any young artists out there trying to write music today, be noted. I'm putting you on notice. Write some good sing-along songs. There really is a... I'm off track here, so it reminds me of another shout out to a guy by the name of Peter Sieber. He's an Opus Dei guy who is dripping with talent. I saw a play that he wrote, and he wrote the play, he wrote the music. He did a play called Coyote Cal, a play about Buffalo Bill and the Wild West, and how during a time in the American past, the Indian issue and racism was so hot and heavy, and how the attempt to look at other people as persons look to the true God as a way to peace was to be brought about. Anyways, Peter Seaver has a he has that book. He also has another play that I saw, which was fabulous, called Where's Django, a play about a a true story. All of his plays are based on true historical events, and the kids that participate in them during their practice time have to learn about the history that surrounds those events, and that's it's a great thing. So Where's Django was a play about a jazz guitarist from France in World War II, and how the swing dance clubs that popped up in and around Paris were kind of a cover where French, who were anti-Nazis during the German occupation in France, were able to gather, and they were dance. It's nothing political here, nothing to see around here. But it did develop into a way of resistance, part of the resistance, which is the real resistance, the resistance that we hear today as a anti-President Trump anthem. I think is sickening, sad to a sickening level, because the debates that are going on in the political world today between more or less the Republican sides and the Democratic sides is nothing near the persecutions that the Nazis imposed upon the German world, or the German world that wasn't pro-Nazi, and the French world and the British world and the Polish world and all the rest. So anyways, so that spirit of timelessness, I guess that's what I was driving towards. And it is a part of thinking about heaven. And it is, it's essential to capture the meaning of eternity in the context of God, who is eternal goodness. There's a beautiful line. What I want to do today is run through some of the great questions that Peter Kreft presents to us in his wonderful book, Everything You Wanted to Know About Heaven. I've talked about this book before too, but only scratching the surface. But he has a beautiful line in there that says, "Eternity gives meaning to our timeline." And I touched on this in my Easter sermon, and it's worth going much deeper. Eternity gives meaning to our timelines. In fact, it gives meaning to every timeline imaginable. So what does that mean? You and I both know what our personal timeline is. Our birth date and the day we die.
Wow.
And in between that is our timeline, right?
You just wrinkled my brain, man.
It's very important to keep that. And then, of course, there's the timeline of America. And you could say the timeline started in 1776 up until present. That's the timeline of America. The timeline of the Roman Empire. The timeline of the Catholic Church. The timeline of different Protestant denominations. And by the way, since I mentioned it, Catholic Church has 2,000 years. All the other Protestant denominations, the oldest ones are 500, since they didn't start until the 1500s. So anyways, we all know what that means, a time. We all know what the timeline means. But to follow Peter Kreft's wisdom, which is based on really good Catholic theology, he's saying to us, eternity gives meaning to our timelines, or every timeline imaginable. What does that mean? let us apply the concept of goodness and rip out the concept of evil. You and I now, while we live in time, we also live in finite awareness of great goodness or great evil. In other words, good and evil are so often mixed together, right, in our lifetime. Entering into eternity, though, the goodness will shine, as it were, and the evil has to be burned away, so to speak, and that's where we get the idea of purgatory. And so where we in our lifetime today oftentimes debate within ourselves about what is good and what is the right thing to do, what is wrong, what we shouldn't do. That's, we argue about ethical choices constantly. But in God, there's no ethical debate going on, right? In God, it is absolute goodness. And so as you discover ethical goodness, you're discovering God. And so in eternity, we will get to look at our timelines, and we will be able to see and perceive, appreciate goodness in a whole new fashion. It'll come to light to us, and even in that coming to light, what could be, in essence, our purgatory, in the same time. It's not that purgatory has to be 500 years. We talk about that often, 500 years in purgatory, and then you get eternity in heaven. The coming to know God will be painful in a certain sense, and that painfulness could be easily explained as purgatory. What do I mean by that? And I use this example at my Easter Sunday. Shows you how kind of a crazy preacher I am. But on my Easter sermon, I said, when trying to explain how eternity gives meaning to our timelines, I just threw out the example. Let us say, some of you who may be divorced, you may be wondering about, was it the right thing to do to marry that person? And if you're divorced, you came to realize that was somewhere along the line. No, it was wrong to marry that person. It was not a good thing to marry that person. And so in eternity, and you may wonder, the person who thinks that in the first person singular, right? I,
wow.
Little grammatical
you just
note
wrinkled
there.
My brain, man.
Yeah, well, that's not even the brain wrinkling. Here comes the brain wrinkling part, is that the I who says, I divorced that person and I know I was right, or I did it because I had to do it, you will say to yourself, oh, yeah, I was right. But put in eternity, and if eternity gives meaning to our timelines, you can wonder— the ex-spouse might be saying the very same thing, right? The ex-spouse will say, I shouldn't have married that jerk. So we both in this world, in our timelines, will say, I was right here and you were wrong there. And we'll be able to debate, and we can and we should try to understand the best right and the best wrong while we are here. But there will be no debating in heaven, as it were. In other words, the divorced people will be put before God, and both will know, as God knows, who was right and who was wrong. You'll say, ooh, you may go into heaven thinking that you were completely right about that decision you made, but then in the presence of the eternal goodness of God, you will all of a sudden say, ooh, I wasn't as right as I thought I was. You mean he or she is right about that? I threw out another example from history to put a little flesh on the bones of this beautiful Peter Kreft insight that eternity gives meaning to our timelines. This, again, was part of my Easter sermon because I said, imagine, we all know that Abraham Lincoln was shot in Ford's Theater back on that Good Friday at the end of the Civil War, right? And of course, you could look at that decision on John Wilkes Booth's part to go there, kill the president. You can freeze that moment and you could say, is that a good thing to do or a bad thing to do? Is that something we should applaud or is that something we should punish? And of course, since I am a fine Abraham Lincoln fan and I'm not a fan at all of slavery, I'm following the great moral virtues of freedom and the importance of freedom in human society, I look at that event and I say, John Wilkes Booth, you were a bad man to have shot the president. Now, of course, many people wouldn't say that. Many people from the Confederacy thought, finally, the tyrant has been put down. And that's exactly what John Wilkes Booth screamed or yelled as he jumped down onto the stage from the booth where President Lincoln was sitting, right? Thus it is to tyrants. We got a situation here. Some people are saying this is a good thing. Other people are saying a bad thing. Okay, bring it into heaven. Bring this event, this part of the timeline of American history or the timeline of these two individual people. Bring it into the timeline of of heaven where only absolute goodness resides. Then you will see. I will say quite boldly what I know to be what God will say. God will say, bad boy, John Wilkes Booth, you should not have shot the guy that I was guiding through the Civil War to help end slavery. And Abraham Lincoln was humble enough to realize he was a mixed bag. He didn't think himself a saint, that's for sure. And he even said that so much of the bloodshed that is being poured out on the battlefields is a scourge by God for all the evil done by slavery. If this war must continue so that every drop of blood from the soldiers makes up for every drop of blood shed by the scourger's whip upon the backs of the slaves is paid for, then so it must be done. So he had that sense of justification, as it were. So anyhow, this is a beautiful aspect, a little bit of an insight into what heaven is going to be like. Wow. From a philosophical way. It's much different.
You just wrinkled my brain, man.
It is much different than opening the books of saints, especially the mystics, and just trying to discover what are you wearing in heaven, or what are you eating in heaven? Is there sexual relations in heaven? Those things all can come into play when you start with this sort of a philosophical meditation on what heaven is, because if you have an idea of what God is, then you'll have an idea of what heaven is. If you're trying to imagine heaven, and you're not incorporating your idea of God, then forget about it. You're just playing God. So that's what this is all about. We'll come back, and I want to get through some of the more great insights of Peter Kreft, the great Catholic philosopher. But we'll be right back. I'm Father Tom Coyes. I'm sitting in for Father Anthony Bush. You're listening to listener-supported The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
Celebrate the glorious feast of the Divine Mercy this Sunday in the historic St. Stanislaus Kostka Church, the sanctuary of the Divine Mercy for the Archdiocese of Chicago. Confessions will be offered beginning at 2 p.m. Mass will be celebrated at 3 p.m., followed by the Divine Mercy Chaplet. A plenary indulgence can be obtained On this feast day, St. Stanislaus Kostka Church is located just minutes from downtown Chicago at 1327 North Noble Street. That's 1327 North Noble Street, one block west of the Kennedy Expressway at the Division Street exit. Plenty of free parking available. For more information, call 773-278-2470. 773-278-2470. That's 773-278-2470. St. Stanislaus Kostka Church, the sanctuary of the Divine Mercy, is open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, year-round, for adoration of the Blessed Sacrament.
The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ and on the World Wide Web at windsofchangeshow.com.
St. Stan's School has an amazing PK 3 through 8th grade program focused on leadership and social-emotional learning, and is one of the only schools to implement the Reading and Writing Project of Columbia University and the University of Chicago. Everyday math across the board, PK 3 through 8th, is taught by our highly educated and dedicated teachers. St. Stan's students are academically challenged with advanced-level placement opportunities as their test scores and high school admissions speak volumes. St. Stan's is an integral part of the Wicker Park community, where you feel welcome and at home with other families and friends who enjoy the same warm, friendly, and safe atmosphere for their children. We have small classroom size, which makes a difference in the whole learning experience. Many schools have excellent programs. At St. Stan's, we empower students to be excellent. Join the St. Stan's family. It is a selective admissions process. Grades 1 through 8 are tested and interviewed. Call 773-278-4560. That's 773-278-4560. Or stop by at 1255 North Noble Street. That's one block north of Division, just off the Kennedy. More information at ststanschicago.org. That's ststanschicago.org.
Hey, welcome back, everyone. Trying to wrinkle your brain a little bit on this is Easter week by meditating somewhat philosophically, whoa, but very theologically on
you just
heaven.
Wrinkled my brain, man.
Indeed, indeed. Heaven is, the essence of heaven is God. And when you look at the scriptures and you look at what the gospels say, especially when Jesus speaks about the afterlife, this is what I think is troubling for a lot of folks and causes us to say to ourselves, the Bible doesn't talk about heaven. We're expecting a narrative, something like a travel agent. You know, if you're going to a travel agent and you're saying, I want to go on a vacation, give me the options. And so the travel agent will say, well, would you like to go to the Bahamas? There's a beautiful resort and has this many restaurants and this many pools, and the weather is this way. And or do you want to go to Europe and explore the great sites of the Catholic cathedrals? You won't be able to see Notre Dame Cathedral. We're here just after it burned down. But we'll see how fast that it gets rebuilt. Sad to say, I'm one of those skeptics who unfortunately has this bad feeling that it was not just an accident. So anyways, but when you go to a travel agent and you want them to explain to you where what destination you're going to go to, they tell you something very vividly. They tell you, they speak in pictures that you can understand. They're using words that you know they can understand. But when Jesus tries to speak to us about heaven, we're not going to get the same kind of information. whenever you look at the Gospels and you see how Jesus refers to, every time he refers to heaven or being in, with God, eternity and all the rest, it's always attached to the will of God, doing the will of God. To know me is to know the Father. To follow me, it's always attached to the moral good. And again, you've heard me say this so many times, my friend, but it's so important. It repeats one of the great crises that is a part of our contemporary church today, and our politics as well. But I'm just speaking in terms of our church. A great problem is the divorce between faith and morality. These two things must go together. We can't separate them. But every time we try to even prioritize them, this one's more important than that. We use what is sometimes called Occam's razor. There was a Protestant theologian in the Middle Ages during the Reformation time named William of Occam, and he is noted for using a razor to make a cut between really the life of faith that gets us to God, that is our salvation, and the pursuit of moral goodness. As a matter of fact, Timothy Gordon, in that great book, The Catholic Republic, has a chapter on how the modern world that we live in today is detrimentally influenced by William of Occam's razor, because in establishing the United States of America, especially upon Aristotelian and Thomas Aquinas, and their wonderful natural law philosophy, and especially the concept of four causes. I think I used this in a sermon, although it's awfully hard to put deep theology in a sermon, but I try. And those who know me say I try. And whether I do it well or not, well, that's something else to decide. But if you're a classic philosopher, you'll remember that Aristotle and Thomas Aquinas beautifully and wisely teach us about how we have to have an appreciation for differences in causes. We're all of us, every one of us is interested in causes of things, right? What caused that? What caused that? Somebody gets sick. What caused that? Somebody's successful. How did he do it? What caused that success? You look up into the universe, you look up into the stars, and you see a big meteor coming toward you. What caused that? Everything. We're all of us are interested in causes. But what we're not aware of is that there really are four different causes. And Thomas Aquinas names them as the efficient cause, the material cause, the formal cause, and the final cause. William of Occam, during the Protestant Reformation, sort of lopped off those two last ones that I said. That, in other words, there are no such thing as formal cause or final cause. There's only material cause and only efficient cause. What does that mean? That means when you're looking for the cause of something, I'll go to my meteor coming to crash into the earth. We'll say, what caused that meteor? Well, scientists will look, and astronauts will blast into space and might be able to find out that something happened in the distant part of the solar system that caused a meteor to go off its track, trajectory or whatever. And I will point out to you all the material causes of this, or the efficient cause. Well, it's hitting the earth because of the gravitational pull of the earth. That would be part of the efficient cause. But what did Aristotle and St. Thomas Aquinas mean when they talked about formal cause and final cause? That is, that's where meaning comes into play. And that's what William Occam said. There's no intelligibility about the thing itself, the form. This is a little bit reminiscent of even Plato and Socrates and all the rest, where they believed in this. The intelligibility of things, namely that wood, for instance, if there's a tree and you have a tree that's and you know that you cut the tree down, you have wood there. The tree is not made of iron. It's not made of copper. It's made out of wood. And so you could say, look, there's a forest fire over there. What caused the forest fire? Well, there's something innate about the nature of wood that has it burnable. Burnability is a part of the nature of wood. And if you have wood, it will be burnable and all the rest. So there's aspects of the nature itself that where meaning is stamped in it.
You just wrinkle my brain, man.
Yeah, that is brain wrinkling. And Timothy Gordon wisely points out that the Protestant Reformation, along with the advance of science in the Enlightenment that was atheistic, that thought they can do science without God, did away with something called formal causes and final cause. A final cause is sort of like the teleology of a thing. It's meant for this. And you could say, of course, a tree might have many different final causes. A tree is meant for, you could say a tree is meant for a wonderful dining room table, or you could say it's meant to be turned into a baseball bat, or you could say it's meant to give beauty to a beautiful forest, or it's meant to house birds. You can have multiple teleology, there's going to be. But William of Ockham, with the Protestant Reformation, said that nature was no longer intelligible in and of itself. Why do I say that? Why does he say that? Why is that an accurate critique of the Reformation? Because the Protestant reformers said truth only comes from the Bible. You don't examine nature to discover what God wants us. See, the arguments between the Protestants and the Catholics during the Reformation had a lot to do with is there an authority outside of the Bible? Luther and the Protestant reformers were adamant by saying there is no authority outside the Bible. And the Catholic churches were saying, well, you can't really say that. As we read nature, as you study, we come up with some answers, and we're quite sure of these answers, even though we didn't find them in the Bible. In other words, you can study nature and you can discover truths about stuff, especially human beings, and you can be sure that that's God's truth. And the Protestant Reformation said, no, you can't. And the Catholic Church with its hierarchy and the theologians and all say, yes, we can. And we're still, Timothy Gordon wisely points out that modern America today, especially the, I'll say it this way, the conservative Protestant modern American, and I count many of these wonderful people as my heroes and friends. There's so much good that's going on like a James Dobson, for instance, a wonderful Protestant voice that has stood up for family and life and all the rest. But they are grandchildren of the Reformation because they're holding on by hook or by crook the fundamental doctrine that the Bible alone is the source of authority. Okay, so I did run a little awry on that topic as we're talking about heaven, but it does fit in because heaven.
You just wrinkled my brain, man.
Yeah, I'm sorry, but it has to be done. We'll go this way. We'll get back to our topic of heaven this way, because you can't understand heaven without understanding the nature of God. And the nature of God has to be infinite. He's going to be eternal, and he's going to be good, absolute goodness, absolute love, nothing of evil or badness in him. So this way of thinking about heaven, divorced from God, is too much like trying to have faith divorced from moral questions. Boy, I heard a good one the other day. I forget who it was, but you know, speaking of the pain and the difficulties of divorced families and children of divorce, it was a Patrick Kaufman show with Dr. Scott Hahn, and they were talking about the pain and the breakdown of the marriage, and the line came out that you know, those who divorce their spouses take the cross that they were meant to bear and they put it on the shoulders of their children. Ooh, boy, that's a powerful one. And in other words, that sort of desire for children to be able to hold on and look up to their...
You just wrinkled my brain, man.
Yeah, that's brain wrinkling and conscience pricking and all the rest for a good number. But the good news is there is always repentance. There is always forgiveness when we are sorry. And especially with marriage issues, there's always the right thing to do. And that is admit the mistakes. And in Catholic life, that means an annulment and all the rest. There's always hope. And so in heaven, that being in the presence of pure goodness for all eternity will indeed burn away all that is of evilness in us. And there will be some in us. We have to have that humility to appreciate that. And so I think that as we approach the Sunday after Easter of Divine Mercy Sunday, I'm super delighted in the idea. Oh, there's that reward room that's here. I delight in the concept of having my evil purged from me. And in heaven, you won't be able to find, you may be able to see badness only in the sense of how it makes you happy, where you've thrown away a badness, and now you're joyful. Maybe like someone who's a drug addict, and they see the pills that are thrown away. I don't want this anymore, and seeing the after they get sobriety or so, they might see the badness of their old habit, and that is part of the joy of heaven. But it's a very powerful concept. What Peter Kreft teaches us, that eternity gives meaning to our timelines, and every timeline that is imaginable. Let's take a very wicked person, and let us say the good thief that hung next to the Lord on Good Friday, right? He must have been up there. He admits it, that he was up there for just cause. But in heaven, and this is a beautiful concept. This is such beautiful reason why Catholicism offers such great insights into life. We call that guy the good thief, and we have even a name for him, St. Dismas, and we consider him a saint. Okay, let's say we meet Dismas in heaven, and are we going to be able to see his bad side? We might be able to see his bad side only in the relationship of how good it makes him now. That could be for all of us too, my friends, especially as we come to Divine Mercy Sunday. Be sure to do the Chapel of Divine Mercy. It's beautiful, powerful. I'm Father Tom Kors. You've been listening to listener-supported The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
What's there to say when the world makes no sense? Do we search deep for truth or sit on the fence? Can you see? Can you see? Can you see the winds have changed? Mm-hmm. each meaningless thought. The shell appears strong, but the inside is wrought. It's time to be stirred. The time is